Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
And the man, of course, is the Motormouth of movies, Mark Kermode, who should be in LA this week. How you doing?
I'm fine. I'm being apparently motormouthy, even on only 2 hours sleep, because here in LA, in Hollywood, it's 6:40, and I didn't get to bed till 4 o'clock because I went to the late night screening of Snakes on a Plane because they haven't shown it to critics. They didn't want to show it to critics in advance. So last night they had kind of audience paying previews. So at 2 o'clock in the morning, I was with the paying popcorn throwing punters in Man's Chinese Theatre watching Samuel L. Jackson fighting snakes on a plane.
It sounds a bit like one of those, you know, when they used to have acid house parties and you'd all have to meet at a certain place and get in a coach and you'd go to a mystery destination. They've been very secretive about this film.
Well, the point is that there is this weird thing in England, generally, you know, the idea of not showing a film to critics in advance is a complete anathema. Here in America, it is a fairly common practice. But of course, what's happened with Snakes on a Plane is that around the world, it hasn't been shown to critics at all. There's just been a lot of internet buzz about it, a lot of people talking about it on the internet, but they haven't shown it to critics. And the theory is that if it does well, it's the beginning of this new wave of, hey, critics, who needs them? So we're all out of a job, frankly.
Well, we're going to review that. Stray Dogs, Clerks 2, so many films. Harsh Times, of course, and a very special guest coming up with that. Stray Dogs as well. But Mark, what are you doing in LA? Is it a holiday? Are you out there sort of hanging out with Tarantino and the likes?
No, I mean, I've come out here for a holiday, but it's like that, you know, it's all, everything is a working holiday. If you come to LA, because the fact is, you know, there's a bunch of movies that you want to catch up with. So what I do is I tend to try to restrict myself to not watch more movies than I absolutely have to. But in the case of this, I had the perfect excuse because there was no way I could have seen it beforehand. It was the first screening anywhere. Of course, it's been wall-to-wall television advertising. Be the first to see it before the critics. So fine, I need to be there at that screening. So there I was with my $11 and my, you know, the best thing over here is with the popcorn. You go into the cinema with the popcorn and you say, I'd like some popcorn, and what size would you like? And small means large, and medium means really large, and large means where can I park my trailer? So,
well, we were just talking about the Ryder Cup there, Mark, and Colin Montgomery is too big for the uniform, and he blames the size of portions of American food.
Well, you know, everything out here is, it's very hard to be underfed here, but that's perfectly fine. I like a large breakfast. I'm just it's very odd sitting in a cinema in which you literally cannot see over the tubs of popcorn and the people in front of you. And the people actually in the screening that I was in yesterday had brought along snakes to wave around. And the film's called Snakes on a Plane, and for authenticity, they delayed the film. The film was late.
Oh,
so by the time it finally came on, the crowd were snaked out of their head.
Listen, there's a few films in particular we're going to be talking about. We're just awaiting Gabriel Byrne on 5 Live. And Jindabyne, a film that you've seen and I believe you've loved.
Yeah, I saw Jindabyne in Cannes. It was interesting because I've never been a huge fan of the Cannes Film Festival. Every now and then you do find little gems there that you really don't know anything about. You don't expect. Well, Jindabyne was one of those. I saw it in the middle of an afternoon. Somebody had said to me, "Oh, it's the thing that they've been most excited about at the festival," and it's a really, really well constructed drama. It's based on the stories of Raymond Carver. If you've seen Shortcuts, there is a story in Shortcuts which has the same source material as this, which is a group of guys go on a fishing trip. While they're on the fishing trip, they discover a body in the water, a body of a young woman. But rather than turning around, going straight back to the police to report it, they figure, well, you know, we're here on a fishing trip, we might as well do our fishing, which they do. Then, of course, when they go back home, their wives are appalled by the fact that they didn't report this straight away. And so there's a Raymond Carver short story which has been already adapted in Shortcuts. This takes that and expands it, adds some other Raymond Carver stuff as well, and I thought it was a really, really interesting, really offbeat, beautifully acted, very, very well-pitched movie. And it's funny because the people I was out there with in Cannes, many of them said it was one of the real offbeat treats that they'd seen in the festival that year. I thought it was really something.
We were mentioning Wawa there, the film before for Gabriel Byrne. Found his performance in that fascinating. Lovely film. And he made it, as he does many films that he stars in, the smaller independent movies.
Well, the interesting thing with Wawa, of course, is it's Richard E. Grant's great pet project that he'd spend an awful lot of time in. It's semi-autobiographical, largely autobiographical, of course. And it's one of those, again, an offbeat film, which it's kind of hard to pitch. It's kind of hard to sell to people. And it's something which the people involved in it put their heart and soul into. Didn't perform massively well at the box office, but got very, very respectable reviews. I mean, I'm as well as Gabriel Byrne, I'm a very big fan of Richard E. Grant. Me and Simon Mayer had this long thing going about whether it's possible for Richard E. Grant to make a bad film. Of course, like everyone, Richard E. Grant has made some bad films. Hudson Hawk is a complete clunker by everyone's reckoning other than mine, of course. But I think Wawa was really interesting. And I think you're right, Gabriel Byrne's performance in it is terrific. And it's just to do with, you know, not necessarily going with the mainstream. And of course, nowadays, I mean, this is more evident here, I think, than it is in England. Here in Hollywood, everything is going mainstream. It's you know, the Snakes on a Plane is the perfect example of this.
It's ludicrous.
Like, if somebody's trying to describe Wawa to you, it's like it's a film about growing up and the difficulties of your relationship with your parents. Again, okay, fine. Snakes on a Plane. What's that? Well, you know what? It's snakes on a plane. And sadly, that is kind of the way things are going. The simple one-sentence pitch is what defines a movie. If you can't sum it up, I mean, this was one of the concerns of the film The Player, which, of course, was made by Robert Altman, same guys who made Shortcuts. If you can't pitch a movie in 25 words, no one's interested.
No one's interested.
And, you know, and really interesting movies, you cannot pitch in 25 words, like Terry Gilliam's Tideland. Yeah. Terry Gilliam was on the program saying last week, the tagline that he wanted for Tideland was Tideland, it's a different experience the second time. Well, that's hardly a tagline that grabs you in, but he's completely right.
Well, listen, we're delighted to be joined by Gabriel Byrne now, who has Gender Bind at the Edinburgh Film Festival. Good afternoon, Gabriel.
Yeah, hi, good to be with you.
Nice to be with you. We've already heard all about, from Mark, the story of this film. Why this story? Why did it appeal so much to yourself?
Well, I had seen Lantana, which was Ray Lawrence's previous film, and I was struck by the power of the narrative, the deceptive simplicity of the film itself, and yet how layered the film is, and how complex it is in dealing with the relationships between men and women, and I think that in Jindabyne, where another very simple and deceptive story by Raymond Carver provides the basis for this new film. Again, a strong narrative, but really it's the examination of the subtleties of human behavior and interaction that is what Ray Lawrence finds interesting. And that's always, of course, great work for an actor, because in the previous conversation that you were having there, yes, I totally agree that mainstream films are now about the removal of any kind of psychological or emotional complexities, because they have to cut for action instead of for emotion, and the themes of the films are. It's not just about pitching the movie in 25 words. It's got to be that you've got to be able to pitch a predictable, sometimes unrecognizable film in 25 words. And you cannot describe the plot of Jindabyne beyond saying it's about a murder. But it's about the effect that the murder has on the people who are left behind to deal with its aftermath.
Is this, Gabriel, what you're saying? Is this what's recently pushed you towards the smaller budget movies with better narratives? Like Wawa recently was a triumph.
Yes.
And this film, does it not sit well with you in recent years? Would you prefer these good narratives and smaller budgets?
Yeah, I'm not snobbish about, you know, bigger mainstream films. I think there's always been a market for them. The problem is that market has become bigger and more powerful. And now even independent movies, which up until now were allowed to, you know, more or less be free of the same considerations, are now subject to the same scrutiny. In other words, they want stars in independent movies, and they want, because film has become so market-driven, they want to know where the market for it is. So somebody like Ray Lawrence, who's only made 3 films in his life, and at 64 he's contemplating maybe not doing any more. He's not making them simply because the pressures of the system on him to conform to the formula and to the market are so great that he feels that power is taken away from him as an artist.
Now, Gabriel, Genderbind survives on its relationship between yourself and Laura Linney, who was obviously, she was in The Exorcism of Emily Rose. How important is it in a film like that, that is based around this relationship, that the personal relationship between yourself and someone who you may or may not have worked with before is there, that the chemistry exists, not just on screen but off?
Well, casting, John Ford used to say that casting was 85% of a film, and I think that's true. If you look at any of the great films, it's very difficult to imagine. There's an inevitability about the people who played the roles. I was very lucky to have worked with Laura twice before. This is our third marriage, and we've been unhappily married all three times. In the first one, it was a picture with Steve Martin called A Simple Twist of Fate, which I think was Laura's first film. And then we did another film together in New York, which I can't remember the name of, in which I was played her gay husband. And now in this one, yes, we had a kind of... an intimate relationship, a working relationship with each other, so it made it easier. But yeah, casting is always a risk, and chemistry between people is an unknown until you actually begin the process. But Laura is such an adaptable and such a beautifully instinctive actress that she tends to just block everything else out and just concentrate simply on what the reality of the fictional moment is.
Now, Mark will know better than myself out in LA, knowing everything about films that there is to know, but I think it was Point of No Return, Mark, that Gabriel starred opposite Bridget Fonda, and you'd have Winona Ryder as well in Little Woman. He's had some great films off of some great female co-stars.
Well, listen, I just say on the subject that Gabriel was talking about before, in terms of what Genderbind is about and what you're talking about in terms of the relationship between the husband and the wife there.
Yeah.
One of the difficulties of this is that, as Gabriel was saying, it's not just being able to pitch something in simple terms. It's being able to pitch a certain thing that people recognize. I mean, one of the things people seem to want from mainstream movies is somebody to root for, like a heroic figure. One of the things about Genderbind, and this is inherent in the relationship between those two characters, between Gabriel's character and Laura Linney's character, is that actually your central character is not particularly heroic. It's about flawed people. It's about the problems that men have being men. And again, I think that's what makes the film interesting. That's certainly what's in the Raymond Carver short story. That's certainly one of the themes of Lantana, which is a terrific movie, and of course got very, very good notices. And that's one of the things that makes the film interesting. It also makes it slightly harder to sell to the public. It's not saying, here is a character that you're going to get behind, you're going to root for him, he's going to, it's not Samuel Jackson in Snakes on a Plane. It's about flawed people. And that, I think, is what makes Genderbind an interesting movie. It's about the flaws that people have. It's about the failings that people have. It's about a crisis to some extent in masculinity. That's not something which the distributors find easy to pitch sometimes.
Yeah. I would agree with you there, Mark. I think that I think in the realm of mythological films, where there's a simplistic relationship between the hero and the villain. It's part of the history of films, and I suppose the history of storytelling. But there's another kind of heroism, and I think this is the kind of heroism that, say, people like Ken Loach and Ray Lawrence deal with, which is the heroism of everyday life, where people who don't have the benefit of a tightly written mythical notion of their status, just people who encounter the huge problems of everyday life and who are quietly heroic, that's who this film salutes.
And the other thing, of course, which is interesting, is that you describe it as, it's a film about a murder. Generally, films about murders are about who committed the murder and, let's see if we can find out how the mystery unravels. And although there is a very small element of that in Genderbind, it is only a peripheral element. The idea of the who done it and the why done it is very, very peripheral to the central story, which is the effect that murder has on all these ordinary people.
Yes.
People who are just living ordinary, normal, to some extent, fundamentally mundane lives, who are suddenly put in this completely strange position by their relationship to the murder.
And it also, in terms of how that plays out, to our notions of guilt and innocence. In this film, the innocent are punished and the guilty go free. And that's an uncomfortable truth, because it is also very much true of life on a more universal and real level, that the guilty can go free and the innocent are punished.
You see, that's why I think that really what ought to be happening at the moment is that Hollywood studios ought to be making movies that are pitched to people like me. Because if somebody said to me, here's the movie and here's the pitch, it's about guilt, doubt and uncertainty. Mm-hmm. It's like, yes, that's the film I want to see, not the film with the guy with the gun chasing the snake off the plane.
Unfortunately, though, Mark, you and I are in the minority, because the movies are geared towards the demographic of the 14-year-old to the 23-year-old male. And whether that's a valid demographic anymore or not, I don't know. But it's certainly the one that the studios make their films for. So I think that if you pitched doubt
guilt
over snakes to, yeah, to those guys who make those green lighting decisions about films, they'd say our audiences are not interested in that.
It's kind of like the ad for Orange that goes at the start of every film you see now. Is there any way you could get a mobile phone into that film, Gabriel? Now, we've only got you for another couple of minutes, so a couple of points. I mean, you started in stage recently, you've made a lot of independent films. Do you see yourself going back that way for a lengthy stint?
Well, I've just finished a play on Broadway. I was on Broadway for 5 months, and stage is, as I'm sure you know, it's a very different discipline and extremely emotionally wearing to do. In this case, I was doing a Eugene O'Neill play, A Touch of the Poet, and to do it for 6 days a week, twice on Wednesday and twice on Saturdays, there's nowhere to hide in that kind of a play. You have to give everything every day. So I've always been drawn to independent movies, and I've always been drawn to directors, you know, and I've worked with some great independent directors, you know, like the Coen brothers and Jim Jarmusch and Wim Wenders and Costa Gavras and John Boorman. And I must say that I did my stint, you know, making mainstream Hollywood films when I lived there. And I tried to pick the best of the ones that I was offered. But I just find, as a viewer, I'm more drawn towards those kind of films. And as an actor, I'm drawn towards those films too.
Well, listen, thank you very much, Gabriel, for taking so much time out this afternoon to talk to Five Live. And by all accounts, Jinder Byne's a movie well worth going to see. Mark Kermos.
Oh, it's a terrific movie. And incidentally, can I just say, on a subject of Gabriel's other movies, the one that you ought to check out that was not seen enough by people was the Last of the High Kings.
Wonderful.
Which was a really terrific little independent movie, which is really worth checking out.
This is a podcast from BBC Radio's news and sports station,
Five Live.
To find out more about Five Live and its sister service, Five Live Sports Extra, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Let's get back to films and Mark Kermode. How are you hanging in there? 2 hours sleep, party animal?
I'm doing very well. Can I just say, on the subject of that, because I flew out to America on Saturday, and the flight that I was on, when you go to America, you have to fill out these immigration forms. There were no pens on the plane at all, because the stewardesses had all their biros taken off them as they went onto the airplane. So there was one pencil on the airplane that did the entire passenger thing as you came into things. So, you know, hey.
Including the classic question, are you a terrorist? which you're not going to turn around and say, you got me there, and tick that box. Listen, I hear the UK top 10 can go on forever. I'm going to start at number 10, and I believe I get the summation from yourself, Mark.
Yes, that's the way it works.
Great. This is the UK top 10. At 10, Superman Returns.
Which is now underperformed at $347 million worldwide and $192 million in the US. And, you know, I just don't get how this is underperforming. I think Superman Returns is actually a very good movie. I think it reinvigorates the Superman franchise. I was a fan of the early Superman movies. I think it does something interesting with the Superman character. And I think the problem is that people just imagine that Superman is two-dimensional. He's the guy with the blue suit and the red pants who can fly and save the world, and therefore he doesn't have enough weaknesses. In this film, there are weaknesses. There is some kind of character development. I mean, this is an interesting example of a big budget Hollywood movie that does have some kind of character development. It doesn't just have nuts and bolts stuff. So I liked it.
But it works with Batman Begins, and we'll talk more about Christian Bale later. It works with Spider-Man, but I know what you're saying, Mark, but where was the scene in Superman Returns where an old woman that I didn't even know her name was about to get run over by a combine harvester, and he just comes in a really bad string, and he lifts her off and he saves her. To the more simple, happy Superman is what I was looking.
Well, the thing is that there is this idea that Superman ought to be simple and happy. And in fact, I'm sure that one of the reasons that I like the Superman, I preferred Superman to Batman when I was a kid and to Spider-Man because, you know, the primary colors, I like the blues and the reds. And I like the fact that the clear-cut moral dilemmas seem to be quite clear-cut. But I think in Superman Returns, it is a much darker, much more interesting movie than one could have expected.
Do you not think our kids have a right on Christmas Day at 3 o'clock to watch the latest Superman movie?
Well, that's all right. They can do that. There's nothing wrong with that. It's perfectly
only,
fine.
Only if they have it in DVD and their parents don't care about the age in the front of it.
Well, you know, hey, here's the thing. Once everything gets on television, you know, it's all that stuff goes out the window anyway.
Absolutely. At number nine, it's Lady in the Water.
It's absolute rubbish. M. Night Shyamalan should be thoroughly ashamed of himself. And I can hear all the way around the world critics like myself who said, you know, wow, he's really good. He's really interesting. He's really intelligent. He's really making movies about something, going, oh, for heaven's sake, how dare you make this absolute... How they got through a script meeting in which somebody said it's a film about narfs and scrunts and diggity-bongs and biddly-poos and... You know, and to say, no, M, I'm sorry, you cannot make this script. This is something that you wrote when you were a child. It's complete rubbish, and you really need to go back to the drawing board and write something which has got a proper story to it. It's absolutely awful, and there's this terrible bit in it when there's a character who's a film critic, who's an idiot, who doesn't understand anything, and doesn't understand the narfs and the scrunts and the diddly-bongs and the beedly-bombs, and of course, oh well, there's a hilarious moment when he gets to meet a terrible end, and you hear the audience is meant to cheer, and you think, you know, if you'd made a good film, you could have made that gag, but from where I'm standing, Em, get a life.
At number nine, Lady in the Water, passionately hated. At number eight, A Contradiction in Terms, My Super Ex-Girlfriend.
You know what? It's all right. It's a one-gag movie, and the gag is the tagline. The tagline is, he broke her heart, she broke his everything. That's it. That's the whole film.
It's snakes in a plane, surely.
It is. I mean, that's the way it's going. My super ex-girlfriend, snakes on a plane. If the title isn't self-explanatory, you're stuffed.
Well, then that's easy. Seven, The Breakup.
The Breakup, again, there we go. It's about a relationship that breaks up.
Brilliant.
So two halves of the movie. On the one hand, the Vince Vaughn half, which is perfectly fine. On the other hand, the Jennifer Aniston half, which is perfectly not fine. So it's half an all right movie. Actually, by Jennifer Aniston standards, half an all right movie is, you know, it's a good quarter above what she's usually up to. It's just a shame that the half that she's in isn't the good half. But Vince Vaughn is Vince Vaughn. He always does exactly the same role. People point this out. He does the sort of thuggy, slightly fat character that he did when he was doing Swingers and Maids. It's the same guy, but I quite enjoy watching him do it.
Okay, at number six, and I'll do my best, is Cabi Alvida Nakena. Explain this film.
Well, I can't, because it was one of the films that wasn't press screened to us.
Okay.
It was apparently the most expensive Hindi movie made in Bollywood. It's clearly raking in the money, but there is still an issue with Bollywood movies not being screened to English-speaking critics. I will go and see this in the cinema when I get back, because it's been very successful. It looks like it's a lot of fun. There are, however, some Bollywood distributors who are now, you know, making attempts to screen films to Western critics as well, and good for them, because it'd be nice to see these things.
Okay, well, Napoleon and Dynamite Riders are at number five with Nacho Libre, which I saw the other night. Mark, I hope we're not going to collide over this.
Well, okay, I think Nacho Libre is fine. I really like Jack Black. I think Jack Black is a great physical comedian. I think, you know, his physical comedy is a terrific thing, and he does it really well. I have to say, I don't think there's much evidence of Napoleon Dynamite in there, other than the fact that the direction is fairly deadpan. If deadpan bordering on the flat, I mean, I enjoyed the movie because I enjoy watching Jack Black in stretchy pants, talking in a funny voice and falling over in a plate of nachos. And a big fat guy and a thin guy in stretchy pants in the ring being attacked by two psycho dwarfs is always funny. But what I didn't see in it was evidence of that really offbeat sensibility that I think you saw from the director when he was doing Napoleon Dynamite. Now, what did you think?
Well, I think you need to see it twice. You know, that first time you saw Napoleon Dynamite, and about 20 minutes in it, you catch on to these regular jokes that keep coming up. When you watch it for the second time, the first 20 minutes is twice as funny. The second 20 minutes is half as funny again. Well, and I think that's what it has going for it. And I would give it a big case.
I'm not saying that Nacho Libre is not funny. I mean, I did laugh consistently. I just don't think... I mean, it's not School of Rock.
No.
It's not High Fidelity. You know, it's not up there with Jack Black's greatest performances. But the fact is, Jack Black in stretchy pants falling over is funny. And I... Anybody could direct a movie. Even Gore Verbinski could direct a movie with Jack Black in it doing that, and it would be funny.
With Jennifer Aniston, the co-star.
No, that would probably be the thing that would actually make it not funny.
And also we have to say about that Tenacious D-style singing, so any fans of the D must get on
that. Well, because there's a Tenacious D movie coming up. When we were watching Snakes on a Plane last night, the trailer for the Tenacious D movie coming up, because it just looks like School of Rock Part 2,
great.
And it is Jack Black doing that. But hey, it's a funny act.
Right, number four, Monster House.
Perfectly fine, animated, semi-scary kids movie, available in both 3D and flat screen formats. I mean, up against some of the stuff, some of the animated stuff which has been out recently, it has more wit, more invention, more verve to it. And I like the fact that it is slightly creepy. It's perfectly fine, perfectly passable, and better than Over the Hedge, and better than, you know, some of the other not great children's animations that we've seen this summer.
Okay, we've had Starsky and Hutch. We all want the A-Team. What we've got at number three is Miami Vice.
It's another case of half a good movie. The first 40 minutes of Miami Vice is pretty bad, and Colin Farrell is really terrible. And you sit there thinking, this is really letting the side down. It's like what they've done is they've just taken the TV show, they've changed the date, but they haven't changed any of the naffness. It is exactly as naff as it used to be on TV. And then about 50 minutes in, there is a siege sequence, and you suddenly remember why it is that Michael Mann is such a great director. You suddenly remember why it is that you loved Manhunter. You suddenly remember, you know, what it was about Michael Mann that you really liked. And the second hour of the film really carries it. For me, it's only half a great Michael Mann film, but it is the second half that you remember.
Well, I do. I've travelled to get away here. And at number two, I know there's things that ignite your passion. I've been warned about it. So far, you have mentioned The Exorcist. I thought that would be in already. And also at number two, we get Johnny Depp, Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest.
Well, yeah, I just don't even know where to begin. Other than to say this, there is a myth in the film industry that critics can kill movies.
Yeah.
If critics could kill movies, explain to me why it is that Pirates of the Caribbean 2 has made so much money. It is clearly one of the most witless, idiotic, empty-headed pieces of trash that the movie industry has ever produced. It's shamefully poor. It's thoroughly undisciplined. It has no story. There, nothing happens, and then there's a whole other movie to come. And I do think that Gore Verbinski is the most witless hack working in Hollywood at the moment. And yet, look at the box. This is the demonstration to me. Don't ever give critics a hard time for, you know, undermining a film's box office. But it doesn't work like that. Critics can perhaps boost a little movie with good reviews, but I have yet to see a critic damage a big movie with bad reviews.
It has to be said as well, Mark, when did Johnny Depp become Jack Nicholson? Surely he's closer to Keanu Reeves.
I love Johnny Depp. I think Johnny Depp is a great, again, physical actor. I think he's a really good physical performer. Look at his performance in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Look at his performance in the Tim Burton movies. He's a guy who understands space and motion as well as, you know, dialogue. I just think that the shame of Pirates of the Caribbean is, on the first day he turned up and did a Keith Richards impression, and no one was man enough to say, you know what, Johnny, no.
Exactly.
That's just not going to work.
Exactly. And as long as that's in the UK top 10, I'll be tuned into the Daily Mail to hear you criticise it, because it's music to my ears. At number one, we get Cars,
which from a design point of view is very, you know, is lovely to look at. It doesn't have the narrative thrust that I think the best Pixar stuff has. I mean, I always said that the worst thing you could say about a Pixar movie is that technically it's really good and it looks great, because with all the other things, with Toy Story, the first thing you say is the characters are great, the story is great, and that is what made those movies great. Everything else was secondary. In the case of Cars, the design is the prime thing. It's the design first. And for me, as somebody who has an interest in that 50s design and pastel shades, and particularly in the cars of that period, fine. But I don't know that it's the greatest kids movie ever made, because I don't know that it has enough narrative, enough characters, in just enough writing to make, you know, to make the thing work. Plus, it's a long 2 hours. By the time you get to the end of the 2 hours, you know, it is the numb butt.
We're going to move on to talk about a new film at the moment that's came out from the man behind Training Day, David Ayers. And we're going to talk about Harsh Times. And David joins us now. Hello, David.
Hello. Good afternoon.
It's very nice to have you here. Now, Mark, what's your first thoughts on the film?
Well, again, it's funny, you know, we've been talking throughout this program about films that are based on character as opposed to films that are based on kind of action narrative. It's very easy to pitch an action narrative, hence Snakes on a Plane. It's harder to pitch a movie which is about character relationships. Now, if you've seen Training Day, which is obviously it was very successful, it's a story about two guys and one day. In the case of Harsh Times, again, you have two characters jammed together in extreme circumstances. One of them played by Christian Bale, who, as you know, is one of my favorite actors. I think he's a really
wonderful,
you know, mercurial actor. And it's about their relationship and what happens to them in a course of a really compressed and difficult period of time in which one of them effectively goes to the edge and then beyond. So it's a film about the characters rather than about the narrative. If you tried to describe it in terms of the plot, you wouldn't be describing the film. David, that's fair?
I think that's very accurate. Something I like to do in my movies is sort of examine or juxtapose personal evolution versus personal decomposition. And I do it in Training Day, where the process of corruption basically takes place in one day or doesn't take place. And the same thing in Harsh Times, where the process of maturing and self-actualization is sort of juxtaposed against another character who's basically decomposing before our eyes in a very rapid piece of time.
Christian Bale, you touched on there, Mark. And David, the reviews of this film and his performance in it have been magnificent. In the way that De Niro used to physically change his body a lot, if you look at the roles that Christian's taken on, he really does put everything into it. And it must be an interesting character to work with over a long period of time.
Oh, Christian's incredibly fun to work with. Well, I don't know if fun is the word, because he's very challenging. He really makes you bring your A game to this. He had just come off Batman, so fortunately he had put some weight on since The Machinist.
Because in The Machinist, of course, he actually looked like he hadn't eaten for about a year. He was really terrifyingly skeletally thin, wasn't he?
It was disturbing to watch. I actually had to turn away at points seeing him that way. But that sort of physical intensity definitely drives his emotional intensity. And the best actors, I think, come from a very physical, natural place.
Now, David, your own story yourself started in U.S. military, and it's been a theme of many of your films.
Absolutely. I was a submarine guy in the Navy, and it sort of rescued me from the distressed neighborhood I lived in. So I do owe the military that, and it did give me the discipline to kind of develop myself as a writer and as a filmmaker. But at the same time, it did leave me with my personal demons, which I've had to reckon with over the years.
Now, this movie is, as we said, about police and loyalty. It's also, of course, about Christian Bale and also Eva Longoria and the relationship between both of them. How did that pan out?
Eva was an incredible actor, and there's sort of a triangle there if you really study the subtext of the movie. And, you know, for me, it's about what's going on off the stage and what's going on in the history of the movie. And an astute viewer might be able to infer that maybe Christian and Eva's characters had a prior relationship at some point during, let's say, a poor point in her relationship with Freddie Rodriguez's character.
There is also, it should be said, a kind of well, I interpreted this as a semi-political subtext in what's going on, because what's happening is that the Christian Bale character is applying to become a policeman. And very early on in the movie, we discover that he's, you know, he's been rejected from that application. But during the course of his decomposition, he ends up effectively being offered work by the federal government in a way which seems to imply that this guy is your worst nightmare. He's completely out of control. He's completely drug-addled. He's completely irresponsible. And yet, he is about to be employed by the federal government to go off and do something for him. And it seemed to me that within that, there's an implied criticism of any system in which Christian Bale in this role could be employed at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's sort of saying that maybe right now we just need bodies to throw at the problem. You know, he's rejected from the police department because of his emotional troubles. But at the same time, he's a very crafty guy who's gaming the system. And he definitely has a skill set that these days is needed.
If we go back to the other films in particular, were you surprised at the reaction to Training Day and the reviews of that?
Oh, absolutely. Training Day was an interesting script. It was my sixth script, and I had been writing what I thought studios wanted, and I was tired of getting rejected, so I wrote something I knew that would get rejected and sort of save myself the emotional turmoil. the thing ends up getting made, and Denzel gets his Oscar, and, yeah. and is quite successful, and it's really lived on in the DVD world. And in a way, it's become my albatross, because I'm really trying to top myself and live it down.
Did you think it would be rejected because it's a character piece, because it's not one of those things that you can pitch in 25 words, because it's about people who are not necessarily heroic? Because again, in the case of Harsh Times, the central character is not somebody, I mean, you can be involved and engage with his story, but he's not somebody you can get behind. He's not somebody you can root for.
I thought that it would get rejected basically because of where it takes place, sort of the culture in the milieu. Nobody was really making downtown LA movies. And the other piece was, is at the time, nobody was making police movies. Genres in Hollywood tend to roll around, and we hoe a deep row, you know, work the field dry, and then move on to another genre. And so at the time, the police genre was really dead. And the other thing I kept hearing was, Dave, you don't know anything about law enforcement. And fortunately, you know, a typical LAPD scandal hit in sort of the selling phase of this, which definitely helped get the movie made. But I mean, as far as, you know, character versus plot driving a script, you know, in my mind, the best scripts, the holy grail, is to where you can't really differentiate between is a plot driven or is a character driven. But when people talk about their favorite movies, they don't talk about their favorite plots. They may talk about the hook, like Snakes on a Plane or a bus that can't go slower to 50. But when they talk about movies, they talk about great characters that they remember.
And in terms of that police movies thing, it seemed to me, in the case of Training Day, that you're referring back to things like French Connection, which, although it's a New York movie rather than an LA movie, it's absolutely about those two characters, about those two. I mean, in fact, the plot of French Connection is fairly nondescript. It's about Popeye Doyle and Sonny. That's the root of it.
Well, I think the great thing about a police movie is that the audience has sort of internalized the rules to the point where they know if it's a cop movie, there's some crime to be solved, and they know that's the engine. And I think in a way it really allows you to let the characters develop and breathe. You know, in this case, my thesis sort of going into this is it would have to take place in one day, and it's basically, you know, the devil and an angel trapped inside of a car. Who wins?
Well, David, thank you very much for joining us. We'll have to leave it there. But, Mark, you stay with us in LA. We get Kevin Smith coming up just around the corner. And I think we've had Snakes in a Plane mentioned, Mark, 25 times in the show, and you've yet to tell us how bad it actually is. We've got to do that before 4 o'clock, OK?
This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Tell us all about Snakes in a Plane, because this is one film, we weren't allowed to say it over here as British reviewers. You stayed up all night to see it in LA, and I really hope you're going to tell everyone to keep the money in their pocket.
Well, I think, listen, we have a clip of it, so I think now would be the time to play it. Now, I haven't heard the clip that you're about to play down there in England, but here's the thing, right? The film's called Snakes on a Plane. The plot is there's a plane with some snakes.
So that's okay, it?
Well, basically, the setup is the guy has got to, he has to serve as a witness against some terrible evil mob boss. He has to get on a plane to go and serve it. Well, whilst he's on the plane, a whole bunch of deadly snakes are let out onto the plane, and there we have Snakes on the Plane. So, a couple of things to say about it. The first thing is that all the internet stories were that Sam Jackson saw the title, Snakes on a Plane, said, I will do that. And yeah. At some point, somebody wanted to change the title, and he said, no. I signed on to do this because it was called Snakes on a Plane. Jackson has subsequently said that what actually happened was that he heard that Ronnie Yu, who's a great director, who directed A Bride of Chucky, which is a terrific movie, yeah. And he's a really interesting guy, was going to make a movie called Snakes. Sam Jackson then got in touch with him and said, what's the pitch? And Ronnie Yu said, well, it's a bunch of poisonous snakes on a plane. And Jackson then said, I want to do that. Now, subsequently, Ronnie Yu jumped ship and left with another director who, I have to say, has none of the style or the panache or the zing that Ronnie Yu brings to the project. Sam Jackson remains. There was a big internet buzz about the movie because the pitch seemed to be so obviously, you know, a hit potential. And as a result of the internet buzz, the company, having made the film, went back and did several days of reshoots in order to up it from a PG-13 movie to an R-rated movie. So the movie now contains a number of scenes that people already know about through the trailers, through the internet. Yeah. The most famous of which is Sam Jackson saying, you know, I'm fed up of these melon farming snakes on this melon farming plane. A line which, when it was said last night in the theater in Man's Chinese on Hollywood Boulevard, when they were previewing the movie, the entire audience said it along with Sam Jackson saying it. So it's like, you could not have more built-in audience expectation and desire for the audience to love the movie.
And a terrible film.
It's not terrible. The problem with it is it's just not much good. I mean, for a number of problems. Firstly, the director really doesn't have the chops. He doesn't have any of the style that Ronnie Yu would have brought to the project. He doesn't have enough wit to carry it off. The second thing is an awful lot of it just looks like a 1970s disaster movie, rather badly done, rather creaky and cronky in a way which isn't necessarily tongue-in-cheek. It just looks like the basis of the film was put together by somebody who really couldn't make films very well but really liked Airport.
Yeah.
And you get what looks like old-fashioned filming suddenly intercut with scenes which look to me like they were done as recut scenes. All the deaths are basically taken from, you know, late 1970s slasher movies. So yeah, we get a bunch of snake attacks, you know, people's eyes, people's mouths. There's an awful lot of snakes biting people's bottoms, an awful lot of snakes biting people's Mr. Happies, an awful lot of bawdy, crude, lewd, rather unpleasant sort of, you know, sexual grotesquery in the opening 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. of the movie, after which it just settles down to be a bunch of people running around on a plane with a bunch of snakes on it.
Do you know what? You went through all of that, and finally, Mark, you gave me a reason to go and see it.
Which is
the first 40 minutes of sexual gratuity. It's about it's going to offer.
But here's
me
the thing: you don't get 40 minutes of that. What you get is in the first 40 minutes, you get a bunch of deaths that look like they're from a slasher movie. You get a movie that looks like it's basically somewhere between Airport and Airplane. You get Sam Jackson resorting quite incoherently to the use of the melon farming profanity in a way which really looks like the studio went back and recut it. Now, here's the greatest criticism of the movie for me. I went to the midnight screening, which is the best way you could see that film, yeah, and I saw it in a good theater on Hollywood Boulevard. It worked very hard to try and keep me awake, and I have to admit there were a couple of moments when I nodded off. You'd fall asleep, you wake up again, they're still running around.
They're still getting killed by snakes.
It's still a bunch of snakes on a plane.
Well,
what's really sad is that with that pitch, with that dumbo, stupid, how much more down market, thicko pitch, you think somewhere in there is a great genre movie. I'm a great fan of genre movies. I think if a movie does what it says on the packet, then great. I don't have any problem with it. I think it's a mistake not to show the film to critics, because in fact, if you had shown this to critics, they wouldn't kick the rubbish out of it. What they'd say exactly what I'm saying. You know what? It's the worst you could say about it is it's not very good. I suspect that it will have a strong opening weekend because everyone's now hopped up to see it, and because it has a great poster, it has a great tagline, it has a great pitch. But in the end, when the dust has settled on Monday morning, there's going to be an awful lot of people going, you know what? It was a bit rubbish, really, wasn't it? And it is. It's a bit rubbish. It's not terrible. It's just a bit rubbish.
Well, I think that's definitely where we'll leave it. If we've got 17 minutes of a show left, I can't think of a better place to put it than with Kevin Smith. He's back with Clerks 2. It's been 10 years since the cult classic, and he joins us now. The first question Kevin has to be, are you sitting comfortably?
I am about as comfortable as I can be in a hotel chair, sir.
Okay, good stuff, because there was recent stories. It made us laugh a lot in the office about when you were working recently as a juror in L.A. They let you stand up in the jury box.
Yeah, I was nursing an anal fissure at that point, which was you were just listening to the talk of the snakes biting bums and whatnot. Nothing could compare it to an anal fissure. You show me a movie called Anal Fissure on a Plane, terrifying. Terrifying. 5 hours of having to sit when you can't, terrifying.
Well, listen, so many emails coming into the show of people who, I mean, there was someone was telling me a story recently about two Edinburgh shows. One's Kevin Smith, one's Sigourney Weaver, and I don't have to tell you the one that sold out first. So Clerks 2, what have Randall and Dante been doing for almost 12 years?
And a whole hell of a lot of nothing. Like, basically, they've been keeping on, keeping on. They've found their comfy little place, and they never really left it, which was the convenience store, until it burns down in the beginning of this movie, and then they're kind of forced to go out into the real world.
Why revisit them now with so much in between? Was it something you were always going to come back to at the right time?
Nah, it was never really a foregone conclusion that I'd that I'd do a Clerks 2. Like, it was never like one day I'm going to get there. It just, there was a kind of confluence of events, and one of which was working on the Clerks 10 DVD and falling in love with the characters again. Another was coming off of Jersey Girl, where I was like, man, I don't want to work with movie stars on the next movie, and I want to do something kind of low budget. It was me wanting to tell a story about what I felt like it was like to be in my 30s and realizing, well, Dante and Randall were the stars of my, what I felt like it was like to be in my 20s film. Why not use those guys as the way in again? And just a nice way to kind of close up the Viewisk universe, that interconnected series of movies, more so than Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, to go out with Dante and Randall, the guys who brought us into it in the first place.
Is there a temptation to make Clerks 2 in exactly the same way as you made Clerks, in terms of budget especially? I mean, yeah. Clerks was made on credit cards.
Yeah, pretty much credit cards. It was $27,575, and initially I was thinking about making Clerks 2 for more along the lines of the Chasing Amy budget, which was $250,000. And it was Scott Mosier, my producer, who was just like, dude, we can't do that anymore. He's like, you don't seem to understand. Like, now, back in the day, it was easy to pull that thing off for nothing. But now people know that we have, like, a studio behind us. Nobody wants to work for free. Yeah, it's like you can't ask people to do that, especially with the crew we work with. We've worked with them on a lot of flicks. And he's like, you know, sooner or later, somebody is going to make a lot of money off this movie. And, like, you're asking this crew to do it for nothing, so that these guys can kind of walk away with a bunch of cash at the end of the day, the studio side. So, you know, he's like, let's do it for a comfortable amount. And $5 million was kind of the figure that we settled on. And you know, it sounds like a bunch of cash, particularly in regards to the first budget, but very low by any studio standard.
That's the equivalent of one snake, I reckon. As simple as that. Kevin.
Exactly. One of those CG snakes might have cost $5 million.
You brought the Red Bank series almost in a complete loop with this film and with Jay and Silent Bob Strikes Back. Where in the world are you going to take them now?
I think I'm done with them. I think Clerks 2 is kind of the way to go out. Get out while the getting's good. To go from Clerks to Clerks 2, it feels like a nice sense of closure, like a book you want to close and put up on the shelf. And next up, I want to do a horror movie instead, do a complete left turn.
Great. Now obviously Afternoon and all that on the radio, but Clerks had the habit of throwing something quite grotesque in your face from nowhere. Whose idea was the Silence of the Lambs take off in Clerks 2?
That was mine, just because Jason Mewes had been doing that tuck thing forever, even long before I'd seen Silence of the Lambs, so much so that when me and my friend Brian Johnson went to see Silence of the Lambs and Buffalo Bill does that tuck thing, we were like, he's doing a Mewes. and so for years, you know, I'd been threatening to Jason, who still does it from time to time. He'll be like, hey, and you look over and there he is, fully tucked. I said, dude, one day I'm going to put that in a flick. And then I ran out of ideas, and so I did put it in a flick. And he was like, dude, I'm not going to do that on camera. I said, why not? You do it all the time for free. You might as well get paid for it. And he said, well, I'm going to start working out then. I got to start doing a bunch of sit-ups. And I was like, dude, you do as many sit-ups as you want. I don't think it's going to make it any longer. You know what I'm saying? That's not what sit-ups are for. And he's like, no, dude, I want my stomach to be all ripped if I'm going to take my shirt off. I'm like, you're going to show your gear in the movie, and you're more worried about, you know, how people look at your stomach. And he's like, well, my gear is going to be tucked. And I was like, my God, I've been outwitted by Jason Mewes.
And you're in trouble with that.
Yeah, really.
Well, Mark Kermode, Kevin Smith, something of a hero to student filmmakers. Have you seen a low-budget film to rival Clerks since Clerks, Mark? And you've seen every film that's ever been made.
Well, it's really interesting. I remember when I first saw Clerks, and I wrote a piece about it for Q magazine over here in the UK. And, you know, I laughed until I hurt. And yeah, one of the things that we did was we transcribed one of the scenes from the movie, a scene which I can't describe on daytime radio. And I said, you know, it was the most pornographic movie I'd ever seen without there being any sex in it whatsoever. And it was kind of like, it reminded me of the first time I saw a film of Richard Pryor in concert. It was the way in which, you know, verbal humor could just transgress just about everything. And I really did think that Clerks was not just an extraordinary calling card, but a great movie in its own right. It was it really does stand the test of time. What's interesting with Clerks 2, and this may well be an age thing. I mean, Kevin was talking about, you know, being 30. I'm in my mid-40s now, so you know, I'm older than those people. And I saw Clerks 2 here in America in a cinema which the audience, I suppose, they were largely you know, 17, 18, 19, maybe 20, people who may not have seen the first Clerks movie. And what was interesting for me was, regardless of whether one thinks, you know, it's as funny as the first one or whatever, there's a sense of affectionately revisiting characters. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me, and Kevin, you know, correct me if I'm wrong with this, it seemed to me that the prime reason for the movie existing was that you just actually wanted to spend more time with those people. Because despite the fact that the American critic Joel Siegel said that it was the first movie he'd walked out of in 30 years because he was so offended by some of the, you know, some of the language. I have to say, making a movie that Joel Siegel walks out, I think that in itself should go on the poster.
It's an achievement, should be an award for that.
Yeah, it is.
There's an honor there.
But it did seem to me that the prime moving force in it is actually you just wanted to get back with those characters. And I felt that kind of odd nostalgia. But, oh, look. You know, look, that's what they look like now. They've kind of grown up. They're like, they're a little fat around the edges. They're still the same guys. They're still the same dopey no-hopers, and they're still capable of talking the same rubbish. But there's an affection there rather than, you know, a kind of caustic thing.
Yeah, very much so. It was like me wanting to kind of extend that story by one chapter, just look in on them years later. Because I was thinking about writing this movie about what I felt like it was like to be in my 30s, and I was like, man, it, you know, it takes a whole different dimension if you're showing characters that people know and taking them forward. I don't know, what I had to say was impacted a bit more by the fact that we know what Dante and Randall looked like 12 years ago, and now we know what they look like today. I mean, the unspoken star, the uncredited star of the first Clerks was its grungy black and white look. Without it, like, the movie couldn't be what it is. The uncredited, unspoken star of Clerks 2 is the gut, the paunch, because everybody's got one. Yeah. You know, like, Brian O'Halloran's got one, Jeff Anderson's got one, I've got one. It's just weird and kind of oddly wonderful to see these dudes just being their age, you know, like being in their mid-30s and having that kind of paunch going on for them. There's something poignant about the whole thing.
There was a couple of things in particular with the film, what's happened between Clerks and Clerks 2, and one of those is three more Star Wars movies, and something you feel very passionate about. Hayden Christensen gets a bit of a bashing in Clerks 2, and Lord of the Rings comes into it too, nuts in that. Do you think, just going off piece a second, that George Lucas did fumble the ball making the three Star Wars movies as a nut of the films yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I'm so not the guy to ask, because I love those first three movies he made, but I was inclined to love them because I grew up watching them, you know, as a kid. That was our mythology. And I remember when the first prequel came out, the Phantom Menace, you know, you had a bunch of people on the internet who went from being insanely passionate and enthusiastic about the idea of a prequel to people like screaming out, George Lucas raped my childhood, you know, and you're like, what? That's a bit overstatement, isn't it? And I don't know. I didn't go into the movie, that whole second trilogy, expecting anything, because I was like, there's no way that these movies are going to hit me the same way that those movies hit me when I was a kid. I was a kid, you know, when I saw Star Wars, Empire, Return of the Jedi. And, you know, I regard them very affectionately in my adulthood, the way I regard things from my youth that you know, still mean something to me, or were such a big deal to me when I was a kid. But there was no way that, like, Phantom Menace, Attack of the Clones, or Sith were ever going to hit me or wash over me in the same way. So I didn't go in with big expectations, and because of that, I was, you know, I was fine with those movies. Like, I thought they got progressively better as he went on. I thought Clones was better than Phantom Menace, and I thought Sith was better than the two combined. But I don't know. It's so weird watching people react to those. People my same age who would come out and be so outraged by them. Yeah. And, you know, it's just like, I don't know. I mean, the movie that the audience that those movies were intended for, kids, really seemed to dig them. Like, I saw that first movie with a bunch of kids, and none of them were going like, Jar Jar Binks is the worst character ever created. they thought Jar Jar was funny and stuff. So, you know, it's all relative. It's all like who the movie's directed at.
And when you watch it, listen, I don't want you to go before four without mentioning Murray in Glasgow and Dean Fuller, and also Jenny in Kilmarnock. Thank you very much for all your emails and texts coming in about Kevin. You have a lot of fans out there. One thing, what's up with superhero film projects, Superman, at one of your scripts, what, you know, Wonder Woman, Green Hornet, getting loads of texts coming in about that. I was thinking, if there was ever, there's a lot of remakes of superhero movies and new stages of superhero movies. What about a new superhero? I think if anyone out there could invent a new superhero genre, it's yourself, Kevin.
Oh, you give me far too much credit. I mean, have you seen my body of work? What would lead you to believe that I could do such a thing?
Absolutely.
Somebody out there, somebody is, you know, who's maybe listening to the show or not even listening to the show because they're too busy scrawling things down on a piece of paper, has reinvented the superhero movie, and one day we're going to see it. I don't think we're going to see it anytime too soon, though, because studio wants to stick with what works, and what works is the, you know, year one storyline, this typical story arc that we're used to seeing. So it's going to be a while before somebody reinvents it. I mean, the last best stab at it, and people that did actually achieve that reinvention of the superhero genre, the superhero movie, was The Matrix.
Yeah.
But you know, Matrix 2, Matrix 3, better left not spoken about, I guess.
Very much not, and we'll not start Mark Kermode on those either. Kevin, thank you very much. Last question, all said and done, when you look back, any a sequel is always dangerous. A sequel is always your second child, I suppose. And are you very glad you've made it? Any regrets of making Clerks 2 12 years later?
Yeah, none for me, man. I love it. It's the one of all the flicks we've made, it's my favorite to date. I don't, if nobody liked it, if it didn't, you know, right now in the States, we're coming up on doing about five times what it cost us to make. We got great critical notices for it. Even if none of that existed and everyone hated the movie, I would still love it because, man, it really just speaks to me. It's one of the five best decisions I made was to make Clerks 2.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Silent Bob. You have a lovely day, yeah?
You as well.
All right, take care. Mark, I'm very much looking forward to seeing it. A good place to leave the films today. 2 hours sleep. How are you feeling? You got through that magnificently?
Well, I'm feeling pretty good. I mean, like I said, the most sleep I got was during the boring bits of Snakes on a Plane, of which there were plenty. But I stress again, from the film company's point of view, it just doesn't make any sense to not show those films to critics because you're assuming that critics don't understand how genre movies work. Some of us do. Some of us liked Basic Instinct 2 because we understood the genre that it... No, seriously. Two people in the world liked that movie. I was one of them.
Stan Collymore was the other one.
Did Stan Collymore actually see the film? If he did, is he walking around? You know, I mean, that's the best opening death in the first 5 minutes, isn't it?
Well, listen, Mark, we've got to go very quickly. Film of the week, what should people go and see this weekend? I'm going to go and see it regardless of what you say because you hate Pirates of the Caribbean. I trust you.
Well, if I had to pick one movie that's on release at the moment to go and see The Notorious Betty Page. That is an interesting film, great to look at, a really interesting piece of work.
Lovely, thanks. Thank you very much, Mark. Off you go to bed, yeah?
Thank you.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.